BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
There are some people who talk and some people who don't, which means that there are some people who leave this place and some who do not leave. You are obviously staying.
Has it ever occurred to you that you're just as much a prisoner as I am?
Oh, my dear chap, of course, I know too much. We're both lifers. I am definitely an optimist. That's why it doesn't matter who number one is. It doesn't matter which side runs the village.
It's run by one side or the other.
Oh, certainly. But both sides are becoming identical. What, in fact, has been created? An international community. A perfect blueprint for world order. When the sides facing each other suddenly realize that they're looking into a mirror, they will see that this is the pattern for the future.
The whole earth as the village. Yes.
That is my hope. What's yours?
I'd like to be the first man on the moon.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show, Friday Drive Time, with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. The New World Order, a secret network of bankers, media barons, crooked politicians and arms producers lurking in the shadows? Or the ravings of crazy conspiracy theorists? Well, along with the Masons, the New World Order is one of the great taboos of the Western world. So who has used the term over the ages, and what, if anything, does it mean today? Plus, the internal politics and the Pentagon of 9/11. Was it a coincidence that so many military exercises were going on the day of the 9/11 attacks? And who was calling the shots that day? Former arms manufacturer turned President, Vice President Dick Cheney, or President George W. Bush? And two buildings have stood empty for decades in Stokes Crofts, here in Bristol, the Carriage Works and Westmoreland House. So a local action group's been launched today to bring them back into use. So why do these owners choose to leave these enormous buildings derelict? And what do local people intend to use the buildings for? Also, food mapping. How secure is our supermarket food supply? And where can we find local food in Bristol's shops? Linda Hull's here from Somerset Community Food. But first, Martin Summers joins me for a roundup of some of this week's other world affairs story. First, Martin, the Israeli embassy in Cairo was stormed at the weekend.
Yes, I mean, this is all part of the rising tension in the Middle East and the dangers of major war breaking out.
So why do you think the Egyptian people were so angry, and what was this all about? Because actually it meant that the entire diplomatic delegation from the Israelis into Egypt had to literally leave the country.
Well, I mean, the conflict between the Israelis and their neighbours has been ongoing for many, many decades, and this is just, a skirmish in that war.
Now, in the Asia Times, Viktor Kotsev was saying Erdogan stokes the flames in Egypt, and that actually one of the possible reasons for this was the fact that the Turkish Prime Minister was actually visiting over there last weekend. What's the relationship like between the Turks, the Israelis and the Egyptians?
Well, the Turkish military used to be integrated into NATO and very, very close to the Israeli military, but the shooting up of the ship last year, which Cliff Hanley from Bristol was actually nearly shot on that ship and then attacked by fascist barbarians in his own country. But I mean, that was a turning point in Israeli-Turkish relations, and the democratically elected government of Turkey, it's an Islamist government, are getting increasingly shirty with the Israelis, even though traditionally Turkey has been one of their allies.
So NATO are actually fighting Islamists in Afghanistan. What are we doing with an Islamist government as in Turkey?
Erdogan represents his Justice and Life Party, I think it's called. I mean, they have a large body of support inside Turkey, so there's no reason why they shouldn't be the government. And he's taking a line which is very popular in the rest of the Arab world. So Turkey is playing to be popular in the Arab world. Erdogan is speaking out on the behalf of the Palestinians, and you know, he's playing a game which is very uncomfortable for Washington and for Israel.
We have another story to do with Israel and the Middle East, and that is Britain is changing the law that enabled war crime charges against Israelis. And this was in Haaretz, Israeli newspaper. Britain has amended a law that allowed for issuing arrest warrants against Israeli politicians who visit Britain. The British ambassador, Matthew Gould, to Israel announced on Thursday, Gould calls yesterday, called opposition leader Tzipi Livni, against whom an arrest warrant was issued in 2009, and told her the Queen has signed the amendment to ensure the UK's justice system can no longer be abused for political reasons.
Well, this is political interference by the British government in the legal system, isn't it? I mean, basically, if Israelis are wanted for international war crimes, then our legal system ought to facilitate that.
Yes,
as it did when we were dealing with Serbian war criminals or whoever. This is basically more special pleading by the Israelis. And we are signing it off.
It's only the very most serious war crimes that you can get an arrest warrant in Britain for.
Indeed.
So why is it, do you think, that we will start to see a sort of flood of Israeli diplomats coming to Britain now?
It was problematic with the Israelis. Tzipi Livni was a top Israeli politician, but also implicated in the Gaza assault, which was named as a war crime. Now, the Israelis are...
This is where tanks were being used against civilians and schools and this kind of thing.
Israel is in defiance of scores of UN resolutions. They've carried out all kinds of attacks over the years, like the assassination of that chap in Dubai, the air attack on Cana, which killed 130 civilians, the attack on Lebanon in the 1980s, which led to 30,000 civilians dying. The Israelis basically are carrying out war crimes, and if you carry out war crimes in the modern era, you've got to expect to have legal consequences follow. Slobodan Milosevic was sent to The Hague, so can senior Israeli politicians be sent to The Hague. That's all there is to it, isn't there?
Interesting that these arrest warrants were taken out by a Jewish lawyer in London. Now, on to our other story. The Unionists, this is over in Northern Ireland, are facing an Orange Order complaint over Ronan Kerr's funeral. This is in The Guardian yesterday. The Protestant Orange Order in Northern Ireland has become embroiled in an embarrassing controversy after one of its lodges demanded that two Ulster Unionists be disciplined for attending a requiem funeral mass for the murdered Catholic police constable Ronan Kerr. Under the Orange Order's rules, members are not allowed to attend the Catholic mass, even though thousands of its members flout the ban, particularly in the countryside where many Protestants live side by side with Catholic neighbours. A letter to the Grand Lodge of Ireland from the Sandy Row Lodge accuses the two Ulster Unionists of selling their principles for political expediency by going along to the murdered policeman's requiem mass. Martin, what are your thoughts on this one?
Well, the good news is that most Orange Lodges are not at all bothered by their members attending requiem masses for Catholic police officers. These people are dinosaurs. They basically have no future in the modern Northern Ireland. And, the fact that both communities were united in that requiem mass for Ronnie Kerr was a great symbol of the strides that have been made to bring the communities together.
Now, there
are
1,200 Orange Lodges in the north, in the entire island. Mm. What role has the Orange Order played over the years?
Well, historically, they've played a rather negative role. But, I mean, the fact is that now they're prepared.
What role has that been?
Well, basically, the Orange Order was set up in the 18th century to keep Ulster Protestant and to keep Ireland under the British Crown. And basically, very sectarian attitudes, classic bigotry, Catholicism was seen as the enemy, very anti-Catholic attitudes, and so on and so forth. But the modern Orange Order is less dogmatic than that. And I think the death of Ronnie Kerr last year brought together both communities united in solidarity. And I think that was a very positive development. There are always going to be people unhappy. There are people on the Republican side who are not very happy. I mean, they're the guys who killed Ronnie Kerr. They're not happy about it either. They don't want the loyalists turning up to his requiem mass either. But I think the people who are unwilling to accept change, and that the communities are now working together, they are a minority on both sides, thank goodness.
Bristol. Community FM 93.2.
Now, two buildings have stood empty for decades in Stokes Croft, the Carriage Works and Westmoreland House. So a local action group's been launched today to bring them back into use. Why do these owners choose to leave these enormous buildings derelict? And that's the first question I'm going to ask to Simon, who's my guest. Simon, can you just explain what it is that you've started this group?
Evening, Tony. We're a group of local residents, and it's now been 25 years plus that that building has stood empty.
Okay, so why is it that someone who owns a building actually thinks it's a good idea to just simply leave it as a kind of rotting shell?
Ooh, could be for many reasons. To speculate, in our current economic climate, it might be better to sit on a building and maybe capitalise on it as an asset, perhaps?
Yes, a speculation, Martin.
Probably borrow money against it, even though they're not doing anything with it. Yeah, because and during a property bubble, it's going up in value year on year anyway, even as a wreck.
That's right.
So, but surely it makes sense to rent it out to somebody, doesn't it? If someone comes along and even gives them £10,000 a year or something, they can then rent it out.
Well, I mean,
somebody else
in
can.
The case
they could
of the
sublet it.
The factory in Portland Square, I mean, basically that's a listed building, so you couldn't really do anything with it without spending a fortune on it. So the temptation to just leave it to rot is high. I mean, Westbourne House, I don't really understand. I mean, that just seems absurd that you've got a multi-storey car park from the 1960s just sitting there rotting away. But we were talking about planning law earlier with Mark
Weston,
and basically planning law favours the developer. You know, there's no punishment if you can go onto it.
So you're saying that really this is some sort of investment? It's like money in the bank,
yes,
really?
Yes.
And they want it also, that maybe the, one of the reasons to keep it empty is that they can sell it whenever they want, can't they?
That's right.
Okay, Simon, so what is this group, Simon Lewis? What is this group and why have you got involved? What are you up to?
Well, as a local resident, I have to look at that building every day. It's a bit of an eyesore, and it's empty. You couldn't use it as a car park because there's no way of getting a car up there. It's just a waste of space, and it's a health hazard as well. People have died in that building, and I want to see something done about it.
So, yeah, but you don't own them, so you can't really do anything, can you?
No, I can, but I can maybe try and influence our planning system.
Okay, so what sort of uses are you suggesting that this should be put to? I know you're actually going out to sort of consult with anyone and everyone that's got an interest in those buildings, but I mean, surely you've thought about what kind of uses those buildings could be put to. What is actually needed in the area?
Well, hopefully through the consultation that we've begun today, we will actually ascertain what local residents and people that use the area would like to see done with the building. Personally, I think there's an awful lot of uses it could be used for. There's a shortage of certain types of housing in the area, as well as business space and workshop space. And there's all sorts of things that could be done with the space. I think, personally, I'm quite interested in how the building's developed, not just what we develop it into.
Now, you've got a little list here. Flats, low-cost, and also possibly market-value flats, offices, shops, small workshops, art space, cafes, pubs, public outdoor space even, because there is a bit of space around the back there, which is kind of outdoor. What chance is there that these are actually going to happen? Because it seems to me these are a little bit, possibly just pipe dreams.
At the moment, a planning application has gone in for 183 flats, shops, three-level underground parking. That is going to cause an awful lot of traffic chaos in the area. It's also going to have a massive impact on the demographic of the area. There's already quite a large amount of social housing in the area. So I think we need to be very, very careful about what goes in there, that it doesn't disrupt the balance.
So what you're telling me is that somebody is actually putting a planning application to restore the building, to actually bring it back into use now. Someone with the collaboration of the owners, or do we know that or not?
I believe a planning application has gone in with the from the existing owners. Bear in mind that back in, 2010, I think an application of 153 flats, five shops and over 100 parking spaces was turned down. And yet now another fresh application has gone in for 183 flats. It's really not what the area needs.
One of the tricks they play is to keep putting in proposals which they've no intention of carrying out, and therefore the building can't be compulsorily purchased. Because, there's a proposal running. And, of course, the whole question is, what do they want to develop it into? Do they want to develop something in tune with the local residents and what they would want? Or do they want to just turn it... That area there is an extension of the city centre, almost. So they could build a load of luxury flats and a big car park for 4x4s, if that's what they wanted to do. And that's the kind of thing they're proposing, isn't it?
They could do. It would take a huge amount of investment. I think that it might prove fairly unpopular with local residents to do such a thing. I don't think they really want to get planning permission. I think they are maybe just
a way of stringing everybody along.
Yeah.
Okay, so what are you actually planning? I know you're doing some sort of official launch tomorrow or down there, and I'm reading here rickshaw rides.
Yes, Pedal Waller have given us a hand. We've been pedalling around today, giving it a little try. Come and jump in a Pedal Waller pedal cycle, and you can give us your opinion. We're going to be putting, I think it's 8,700 questionnaires through duels from Cotton Brow to the M32, so a broad area, a lot of people being asked, as well as tomorrow between 10 and 1 on Stokescroft, outside the carriage works, we'll be asking people for their opinion.
So in a way, this is going to be used by the City Council, potentially anyway, to fight this application as evidence at the Planning Committee, saying, actually, no, this is what's needed in the area, not what the developers are going to do. So could we not see that your action may, you know, over the next few years, simply mean that the place continues to stay derelict rather than be converted into flats?
Well, the existing, well, the current application already doesn't go along with the local plan, so it's not going to get through.
It's unlikely to get planning permission, but then they would appeal, won't they? As we keep hearing, like that, like that, these stadiums in the countryside seem to keep doing.
Or they'll just come up with another ridiculous plan rather than appeal. We can't do that, so we'll come up with another one. As you say, they'll come up with 180 flats because they got turned down for 150 or whatever it was.
Yeah. However, perhaps we can find or put together a developer that is willing to put in an application that is within the local plan and within the community vision we hope to draw up from this consultation, or even perhaps the actual current owners will listen to the community consultation and begin to understand what they need to put an application in for in order to get permission. And if they're not willing to do that, then I'd like to force the council's hand on this, because it's about time something was done about it. As a local resident, it is a real detriment to the area, really drags it down, and it could be a real asset to the area. So it's about time that the council pulled its finger out and did something.
I know it's a bit of a dangerous area as well. There have been a couple of deaths in there, haven't there, over the years. But ultimately, if I was the owner of the building and I had it, was using this derelict site as just money in the bank, as we said earlier on, I would want to sell it for as much as possible, and that means flats and possibly luxury flats.
Possibly. If you want to see a financial return on your investment, then you want to speculate, don't you? And you're going to spend a lot of money on digging out a huge underground car park for your 4x4s and some luxury apartments. Alternatively, we could look at a different financial model. We could potentially have a look at the social return on the investment. That's something I'm personally in favour of. Perhaps by getting a local development together that can refurbish the building, creating local employment, tackling youth unemployment, we would see a really, really massive return on probably quite a humble, simple refurbishment of the building that just brings it back into use, stops it being an eyesore, stops it being a hazard.
Now, I know there's a lot of people in the city with strong feelings about this who go past it regularly. I certainly, when I was living in that part of the city, also was tearing my hair out looking at it as I went past. How can people actually take part in this consultation? I notice here you've got some drop-in sessions at the cafe opposite the carriage works. And, you know, sort of how are you scooping up all these opinions?
Well, you won't miss us. We've been out in our bright green T-shirts today, asking you what you think. The drop is actually Cafe Kino, which is directly underneath the building, next to the Arts House on Stokescroft. We're going to be outside there tomorrow between 10 and 1 with our questionnaires, trying to grab as many people as possible. Obviously, these questionnaires will be coming through local residents' doors as well. There's going to be a few drop-in sessions over the next few weeks. The consultation is going on for 4 weeks. Thursday the 29th, 2:30 until 4:30. Tuesday the 4th of October, 9:30 till 11:30, and Wednesday the 12th of October, 4 till 6. Also, we got a web address. I hope it's gone live by today. It's carriageworks.org.uk. So I think you can even fill in the questionnaire online. But really, we're after as much feedback from local residents as possible. So just and businesses and local community groups. So we're going to be out there engaging with as many people as possible.
And if you can't actually make one of these dates specifically, can you just drop into the cafe sometime over the next couple of weeks?
I'm sure there will be questionnaires on the counter at the cafe. I'm sure the staff there will be happy to help. There'll be the dates when the action group will be in attendance. But I don't think you're going to miss our consultation. We're going to be everywhere.
Okay, Simon Lewis from the Carriage, you've got your lovely, sporting your wonderful green T-shirt, Carriage Works, what do you think? Thanks very much for being with us today. And now we have some music, and then after that we'll be talking local food.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
They say we've got to keep a hold of all our bankers, because they're so clever and so talented, you know. And if we don't give them their bonuses and millions, then they'll just pick up their briefcases and go. Well, they're so clever that they bankrupted the country, and they're so talented our taxes bailed them out. And the government is frightened by their puny little threats, but the rest of us just want to scream and shout. Go, just sort off now and go. And you could all leave your passports at the door. And the same goes for your houses, your money and your cars. You're not welcome in this country anymore. No, you're not welcome in this country anymore. Well, they gamble with our money on the markets, which is not the function of a bank at all. And they're paid 100 times more than someone who saves lives. Well, it's time we deal with this once and for all. I say let's tax them till their testicles are tiny, and make their bonuses some tickets for some planes. And then we'll show the world how we can get along just fine without their talented, enormous, super brains. Go, just sort off now and go. You can all leave your passports at the door. And the same goes for your houses, your money and your cars. You're not welcome in this country anymore. No, you're not welcome in this country anymore. But the government is friends with all the bankers, like Karl Marx predicted all those years ago. And although they caused a mess, they got stooges in the press who are desperate to keep the status quo. So the city boys get richer by the hour, while all we get are sackings and cutbacks. And they're brutalising Greece with their IMF police. Yes, it's time to grab those gold men by their sacks. Go, just sort off now and go. You can all leave your passports at the door. And the same goes for your houses, your money and your cars. We're not welcome in this country anymore. No, you're not welcome in this country anymore. We already own some banks, well that's a good start. All we need to do is nationalise the rest. Make the banks work for the people, not the other way around. Put the speculators all under arrest. And as they queue to leave the country for the last time, if they dare to moan, or one will give it large. To them they're lucky they're not stitching mailbags, cos they would be if Attila was in charge. Go, just sort off now and go. You can all leave your parcels at the door. And the same goes for your houses, your money and your cars. You're not welcome in this country anymore. Go, just sort off now and go. You can all leave your passports at the door. And the same goes for your houses, your money and your cars. You're not welcome in this country anymore. No, you're not welcome in this country anymore.
That was Attila the Stockbroker and one of his most recent songs, All About the Bankers. And now I'm joined by Linda Hull, actually an old friend of mine from Eco Village Network many years ago. Hi, Linda. Welcome to Drive Time.
Hi, Tony. Thanks for the invite.
Now, you're up to food mapping. What is food mapping?
Well, food mapping is a way of documenting where your local food resources are, essentially in a way so that you can make them visible and protect them.
Now, what about supermarkets? Because are there ways of actually getting, I mean, how successful are local food producers in actually getting their food into our local supermarkets?
I think there are supermarkets that are making attempts to source local produce. I think Asda is one famous example. But most of the local food producers I speak to are really keen to develop alternative kind of distribution networks that don't rely on these major corporates.
Because they can be quite bullying, can't they, the supermarkets, and act like a kind of cartel where they're saying, actually, we're going to pay you as little as possible for your produce.
Well, I think they lure people in and get them to invest, spend loads of money, get in hock to the bank, up to their eyeballs, and then just completely, you know, push the price down so low that people can, producers cannot service those loans, and then they go bankrupt.
So have you been mapping the way that food is going into Bristol and where it's coming from and how much of it is coming in locally then?
Well, I've been actually mapping in Somerset specifically, but there is a woman called Joy Carey who's recently written a very detailed report about who feeds Bristol.
Now, are we actually self-sufficient in Britain in food? Can we actually feed ourselves? Because we import a fantastic amount, probably at least half of our food comes by ship and by plane, doesn't it, into Britain?
We haven't been self-sufficient in food since the middle of the 1800s.
But ultimately, could we feed ourselves, do you think?
some people think that we could. We'd have to change our diet and we'd have to use land in a very different way. But I think increasingly we're going to need to meet as many of our local food needs closer to home as possible.
So going back to this original question, what is the point of this food mapping? And I know you've actually got some sort of internet food mapping website. What's the point of it all?
If you go and look at foodmapper.org.uk, it's an open source wiki type website where you can plot your local food resources. So everything from existing growing spaces, so that's allotments, community gardens, community orchards. You might look at mapping where local food can be bought, so local food co-ops. You can map events and training opportunities. So if you want to learn how to grow food, those opportunities can be mapped. But I must say that it's up to the people of Bristol, let's say, to map their local food resources, because it does really require local knowledge, local intelligence, because there's the people who live here who know where those food resources are. Once that information's in there, that's when you can really start to use it as more of a planning tool, so you see where the gaps are, where the opportunities are, either whether that's, you know, you've got great long waiting lists in Bristol, okay, well that's an indication that more land needs to be provided for people to grow food on. Or, you know, you can see where there's a dearth of local fresh food available, you can see that there's an opportunity there to potentially provide local fresh food in that area.
What about farmers markets? Because these are great places. I love them anyway. And are there many around Somerset and here in Bristol?
There's loads of farmers markets. I think one of the first ones was in Somerset, started in Somerset in Bath. We've mapped all the farmers markets in Somerset. We've mapped all the country markets. That's what the WI markets are now called. So we're really trying to make our local food webs visible, because food really is too big to see in many respects. You know, we're used to going to the shop and it's full of food. But what we're trying to do is make those food webs visible, so that essentially, with all the major upheavals going on in the world, you know, we need to make those webs visible so we can protect them. And you were on about supermarkets earlier. Supermarkets tend to come in and completely smash local food webs, and lots of settlements, lots of places are threatened with that kind of thing now.
Now, I can think from one place, for example, Shepton Mallet, where this massive Tesco's appeared on the outside of the town, and not only is it taken out the greengrocers in the town itself, but many of the other shops have had to close. Martin, we're up against quite a sort of behemoth here and a cartel of supermarkets. Do you think that there's much point in trying to fight them? Because they're far more powerful than the small producers and the small old greengrocers shops, aren't they?
There's every reason to fight them. Basically, the rules are rigged in their favour, which is why they get away with what they get away with. But that's not satisfactory. People are more conscious than they were about the impact of supermarkets and where food comes from than they were 20 years ago. That's all to the good. It's a long uphill struggle, but, you know, I praise those who are taking the effort to get stuck in.
Linda, can you just remind us where we can find your food map on the internet? Because that's one of the reasons to use it, of course, is to actually find out where these markets are taking place around you, where there are alternatives to the supermarket in your local area.
Absolutely. If you go to foodmapper.org.uk, and what you'll find there is we've done an awful lot of mapping in Somerset, so, you know, Somerset features strongly on this map, but it's really an invitation for wherever you are to start mapping your own local food resources. So you'll go to Bristol, you see there's a few plots on the map there, but fill it up, you know, make it yours.
Linda Hull from Local Food Mapping, thank you very much for joining us.
BCFM 93.2, Bristol is our community.
She's crazy like a fool.
What about Daddy Cool? We'll be right back.
because she believes in him. She loves her daddy.
There and Daddy Cool. Now, Martin Summers is joining me and for a little discussion on the politics of 9/11. Can you just tell us, Martin, a little bit about the background of George W. Bush and Dick Cheney?
Well, I mean, they're both Republican politicians. Cheney's a real insider. Many people would say that he was probably a conspirator behind 9/11. George Bush basically is a glove puppet, does as he's told. But they're both Republican bigwigs. Can I just mention, by the way, that on Wednesday next week, the 21st of September, in Colston Hall, there will be a film show of the UK premiere of the latest film from Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, which is based in the US.
This is a special film to mark the 10th anniversary.
Yes, it is. I mean, we had Richard Gage, who is the founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, in Bristol in July. He is basically an architect who builds skyscrapers, and even as a Republican voter, he voted for Bush. He's saying, as an architect, I have to tell you, those buildings did not collapse under their own steam. But anyway, the film is the latest production from Architects and Engineers. It's at 7:30 in Colston Hall, and the entry fee is £3. And not to be missed, especially if you did miss Richard Gage when he was here in July. Vital information.
So, was it a coincidence that so many military exercises were going on the day of the 9/11 attacks? And who was calling the shots that day? Was it former arms manufacturer from Halliburton turned Vice President Dick Cheney? Or was it President George W. Bush? Well, I asked these questions to author and historian Webster G. Tarpley, and I interviewed him a few years ago on this topic, so here he is now.
Not enough attention has been paid to the political evidence, and the political evidence is two things. One is the ultimatum to Bush from the secret government, from the rogue network. In other words, the people who carry out 9/11 send Bush a threat. Angel is next, Angel being the code word for Air Force One. And it means, Bush, you are a target, with the idea then being, if you don't do what we want, we can do without you. We can liquidate you even in the course of the day. And what they want is the war of civilizations. They want him to announce terrorism. They want him to start talking about bin Laden, Al-Qaeda. They want him to invade Afghanistan. And when this threat comes in at 9 to 10 o'clock in the morning, I have a whole chapter in my book about it. I'm indeed the only person who writes about it. The thing is in the New York Times, confirmed by Condoleezza Rice. There's no doubt that it happened, and it's real. Debka, which is, of course, close to the Mossad in many ways, they confirmed it. Namakon, a group of KGB old boys who have an internet site in Russian, they confirmed it. And Réseau Voltaire, using, I believe, Russian and maybe some French sources, also confirmed that this happened. So Thierry Maison, the first guy who really wrote about 9/11, is also on this line. So the idea, therefore, is that Bush is not a part of this planning. He's not a mastermind. He's not somebody who's, you know, told in advance what's going to happen. He's put in front of a fait accompli. One of the points of this thing is to get him to be active in a way that he would not do otherwise, since his general personality state is catatonic.
And slowly over the day, his line changes.
Right. Yeah, because he says terrorism in the school in Florida. He says terrorism, and then when he gets to Barksdale, Louisiana, he does not mention terrorism again. And then when he finally makes a speech in Washington in the evening, he He makes clear that he has capitulated to the rogue network in the course of the day by saying, we will make no distinction between terrorists and those who harbor them. And by that time, with Richard Clark screaming, bin Laden, Al-Qaeda, Al-Qaeda the entire day, it's clear that that means he's going to invade Afghanistan. So he has, in effect, capitulated to the rogue network, or, you know, rushed to become their eager puppet. And that's something that, you know, Tony Blair reportedly prodded him to do it. Tony Blair came in on the side of starting the war of civilization. So that's so one. That's the angel is next. It was denied later by the White House, but it did happen. And then what? Then we have the drills, right? That's the other thing. 25-plus drills. A lot of them are taking place on the morning of September 11th. Some of them have just been wrapped up in May, June, July, August. Some of them are in advanced stages of planning. So these represent capabilities. And 25-plus drills, you don't have to take my word for it. Paul Thompson, even though Paul Thompson really believes in the official version, has done yeoman service. If you look at the 9/11 complete timeline of Paul Thompson at Cooperative Research on the Internet, he's got a whole long article, which is nothing but the drills of 9/11.
Now, probably the most important of those is the nuclear warfighting drill.
That would be the Global Guardian drill, right? That the skies are filled with nuclear bombers, the missiles and submarine-launched missiles are ready to go. Ivashov in Moscow says before any airliner was hijacked, he could see a huge display of thermonuclear power being put into the skies, right, from the satellites and radar that he had. And that is obviously designed to intimidate Russia and to prepare for the fact that in the course of the day, one of the things the rogue network wants is to give an ultimatum to Russia that the U.S. is going to seize Afghanistan, which is a country that in the past Russia had considered essential to her security, and they'd fought, God knows, a bloody war for 10 years to keep the place neutral. And it had remained neutral, more or less, but now the U.S. is going to seize it. A certain kind of Red Army traditionalist might have said, no, that's casus belli. But, of course, Putin, much more flexible, highly intelligent. I thank the lucky stars for Putin on that day and since. He is the most intelligent and flexible head of state in the world that we have. And he chose a policy of war avoidance, which was to say to the neocons, you want Afghanistan? Wonderful, take it. You'll see what you find.
Okay.
Weakness and defeat, and Russia will get stronger, and the U.S. will get weaker, and that's exactly what has happened.
So this is another aspect that many people about 9/11 don't realise, Martin, that there was actually a nuclear war fighting exercise going on the same day, which, of course, you know, is really aimed at the Russians.
Yeah, and you've got to remember that Webster Tarpley there is very close to General Ivashov, who was commander-in-chief of the Russian armed forces on September the 11th, 2001. So he's basically got an inside track on Russian thinking about what went on that day.
But what about this alleged threat to Bush whilst he was in mid-air between Florida and Barksdale Air Force Base, which is one of the most secure Air Force bases in the country?
As a spokesperson for Reinvestigate 9/11, and I was actually on Press TV last week, and if you go to their website, you will see that I'm still there.
On the Epilogue
program. On the Epilogue program on Press TV. I think that I listen very carefully to what Webster says, because I know he's got very good contacts, particularly in the Russian intelligence community. But at the end of the day, I don't presume I know what happened on 9/11, and nor should anybody else. We've basically not had a proper inquiry into any of it, and the huge gaps exist in our knowledge about what actually happened. We suspect that it was an inside job carried out by CIA and Mossad. That's what General Ivashov's saying. That's what General Gul, who's head of the ISI in Pakistan, was saying. That's the kind of thing that I suspect, but I wouldn't presume that I knew, and we still don't know what actually happened.
Well, one thing's for sure, there were certainly lots of exercises going on at the time. Yes. As Webster there talks about 25-plus drills. And one of the things that's been released as part of the 10th anniversary are some recordings of NORAD's air traffic control communications with the civil aviation. We're going to have a listen to some of that now. It's just over a minute's worth of rather, you know, there's not the sort of thing you normally hear on the radio, is a minute of air traffic control. But see if you can pick out what I picked out here, which is lots and lots of references to questioning. This is the air traffic controllers questioning. Is this is this real world, or is this an exercise? Martin, can you just tell us what the significance of that is?
Well, if it was a false flag event, the way you'd make false flag events happen is you have an exercise of airliners being hijacked and crashed into buildings, and while the exercise is going on, the exercise suddenly turns out to be a real event, and that of course is how you sneak it past the air defences of the United States, etc.
So this is about a minute of air traffic control recordings from the date of September the 11th itself, and beginning with communication with one of the airliners, and you can quite clearly hear one of the hijackers speaking through the microphone to air traffic control.
Is that American 11 trying to call?
Buddy, we have some planes that can stay quiet and you'll be okay. We're returning to the airport.
And who's trying to call me here? American 11, are you trying to call?
Nobody move. Everything will be okay. If you try to make any move, you'll danger yourself and the airplane. Just stay quiet.
Roger's weapon, Sergeant Powell.
Hi, Boston Center, TMU. We have a problem here. We have a hijacked aircraft headed towards New York, and we need you guys to... We need someone to scramble some F-16s or something up there to help us out.
Is this real world or exercise?
No, this is not an exercise, not a test.
Okay, hey, hold on one second, okay?
Yes.
Hey,
what? What was that?
Real world. Cool. I've never seen so much real world stuff happen during the next. Okay, mode 3, 1443, last known. No, this is real world. Okay, we're in the high chair.
I got a Z-point.
Sir, last known position that we got out of this guy was right there at the Z-point.
So that's a little snapshot there of some of the air traffic control communications. Martin, do you think that this is something that is normal for air traffic controllers to be questioning if this is real world or is it
well,
an exercise?
As one of them said towards the end there, I've never seen so much real world during an exercise. So there clearly was exercises going on.
And what might be the actual consequence of having an exercise on the same day as a big attack?
It means that your defences are basically disabled. And of course, the question that people should be asking themselves 10 years afterwards, where was the United States Air Force in the most important day in its history, where airliners flew around inside the most heavily defended airspace on the planet, including the Pentagon, the most heavily defended spot on the planet, which actually has missiles around it which are primed to go off any plane coming anywhere near it. Who switched those off? Why did the United States Air Force fail so dramatically on September the 11th, 2001?
Good question.
The answer is because they were carrying out all sorts of exercises which disabled them. That's probably what the answer is, but we don't know because we're not at a proper
investigation. Including, apparently, also from Dick Cheney, an Air Force stand-down. But one of the consequences of the September the 11th attacks, of course, has been a massive indent into Western civil liberties. And Gordon Carrera reported for the BBC News earlier this week that Abu Zubaydah, who was an Islamist suspect, was waterboarded. And he is someone who's blown the whistle is a former FBI agent, Ali Soufan, who Gordon Carrera spoke to earlier in the week. So let's have a listen to that report now.
Some in Washington believed Abu Zubaydah knew more. He was about to become the guinea pig for what the CIA called enhanced interrogation techniques.
We're seeing some stuff that if it happens in America, the person will be arrested. Absolutely. It's kind of like an abuse of a prisoner.
He threatened to arrest the CIA contractor who was leading the interrogation. The FBI told him to come home. Zubaydah was then waterboarded 83 times.
The interrogations were used on hardened terrorists after other efforts had failed. They were legal, essential, justified, successful.
Are you saying that Dick Cheney is lying?
I know that Dick Cheney is not saying the truth because I was there. Everything the proponent of enhanced interrogation techniques claim that was obtained because of enhanced interrogation techniques and waterboarding on Abu Zubaydah, we got when we were on the ground over there before even enhanced interrogation techniques existed.
Soufan has a book published today. The CIA demanded heavy cuts. It is, he believes, part of a wider attempt to control the official account of 9/11 and the last 10 years.
So what's the significance of that, that report, Martin? It is rather worrying to hear there that an FBI agent actually attempted to arrest a CIA contractor who was torturing Abu Zubaydah and in fact was instead recalled to the US by his bosses at the FBI.
Yes, well, it means various FBI and CIA people have actually spoken out. I'm thinking now of Susan Lindau from the CIA and Sybil Edmonds from the FBI, Colin Rowley. Basically, people at lower levels were basically doing their job. People at higher levels were frustrating them. Now, don't forget that if you've got a situation where you can disappear people into secret prisons and torture them, then you can cover your tracks, and you may be the perpetrators, but you can torture people to admit that they did this and that and the other, and that, of course, then covers the tracks of the real perpetrators. People are not to be trusted with this. That's why we have a proper legal system, although it's been undermined completely by these barbarians, frankly.
Now, another problem coming a little bit closer to home is revealed in a new film, which is actually about the 7/7 London bombings, and looks very closely at many of the reductions and attrition of civil liberties that's come as a result of that. It's called 7/7 Crime and Prejudice, and in this little section of the film it talks about Mohammed Hamid, who's been jailed for going paintballing.
For going camping, letting the BBC take him paintballing, and making some poorly judged statements, Hamid could stay in prison for the rest of his life. Those who know about his case generally believe that Hamid was set up by the authorities and that he is completely innocent. It may be significant that the only man who was prosecuted but not convicted, Musa Brown, was approached by MI5 shortly after his arrest.
This was after I'd been charged and my solicitor had gone. I was approached by the spooks in the interview room afterwards. And the first thing they said to me was, "Assalamu alaikum," and I looked the guy up and down. I thought to myself, what's going on here? And then the guy said to me, the first thing he said to me, and it will always stay in my mind, he goes, "We know you're not a terrorist, but we can help you."
Well, I mean, this is the sort of manipulation that goes on. We suspect that Harun Rashid Aswat was the mastermind behind the 7/7 bombings, but he was taken into preventive detention, and now he's disappeared into Broadmoor, having supposedly gone mad. But he was named by John Loftus, former Attorney General in the United States, as an MI6 double agent. So in actual fact, we've got what we suspect is going on is that NATO intelligence agencies have for decades been involved in false flag terrorism. It used to be the fascists and the Red Brigades, what we saw with Andres Breivik in Norway, maybe another aspect of this, nobody's quite sure. But you can't trust the intelligence services to investigate these events because they are often suspects, and that's why torture is a no-no.
That's a bit worrying, isn't it, in the paintballing case, where one of the suspects is approached by the spooks and said, "Will you now start working for us, please?" And the other one has to go to jail for life.
Yeah, because what we're doing is creating an enemy, creating a threat. Many of the people who've been sent down in the United States as supposed terrorists since 9/11, the FBI or these authorities have basically set up all of the plots, provided the explosives, created the whole plot, and then when they draw young impressionable people into the plots, they then nab them and say, "Oh, look, these guys are terrorists." But they were actually involved in plots that were created by the FBI. Now, this is actually entrapment. The World Trade Center bombers in 1993, that was an FBI plot from start to finish. And as soon as the bomb went off and six people were killed, they arrested everybody and said, "Oh, look, these guys are terrorists." But in actual fact, the FBI had set the whole thing up. Now, that is basically an attempt to manipulate the public in general through a strategy of tension, as was done in Italy during the 70s and 80s.
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Now, moving on to our feature on the New World Order. A secret network of bankers, media barons, crooked politicians and arms producers lurking in the shadows? Or is this just the raving of crazy conspiracy theorists? Well, along with the Masons, the New World Order is one of the great taboos of the Western world. So who's used the term over the ages, and what, if anything, does it mean today? Now, we're going to go through some of the various people who've used this term over the last 100 years or so. But first, Martin, what's your first impressions on the term? Is there actually any use using the term New World Order? Does it really mean anything?
New World Order is used by a variety of people to a variety of different ends. And what it usually means is some big sea change in international politics, the end of World War One and the Versailles Treaty, the end of World War Two and the Bretton Woods Agreement, you know, these were New World Orders in their day.
Well, you get 10 out of 10 for that, because the Free Dictionary Online, which may not be quite up to the standard of the Collins Dictionary, but it says, any period of history evidencing a dramatic change in world political thought and balance of power. But most importantly, where has this term come from? Well, one of the first people to mention it was Woodrow Wilson, US President, and his 14 points after the First World War. So, Martin, can you just give us a bit of the context of what was going on with Woodrow Wilson after World War One, and why he might have mentioned a New World Order as part of one of his speeches?
Well, Woodrow Wilson basically persuaded the Americans to get involved in World War One on the understanding that what would happen at the end of it was that the old way of doing business in Europe would be ended, and a rules-based system would be set up. And so Woodrow Wilson pushed. I've just been reading a book called The Lights That Failed by Zora Steiner, covering this period, and, you know, basically that a rules-based system would be set up, and it wouldn't just be the kind of free-for-all that had been seen in Europe previously. And that led to the founding of the League of Nations. But of course, Wilson's misfortune was that conservative forces in the US didn't want to get involved in his scheme, and the US did not join the League of Nations.
Now, moving on to 1940, just at the beginning of the Second World War, and the science fiction writer H.G. Wells, a famous author, he actually wrote a book called The New World Order. What do you know about Wells and his politics?
Well, Wells was a socialist, and his idea of a New World Order would presumably be a better world with, universal health care, universal education, steady improvement in living standards, and so on. So that's what he probably meant by New World Order.
Now, Maulana Muhammad Ali wrote a book in 1944, was actually again called The New World Order, arguing that only Islam can establish lasting world peace. That's sort of quite
current. I wasn't familiar with that one, but there you go. I mean, people basically, everybody uses the word New World Order to imply to, some people use it negatively, some people use it positively, but what we're really talking about is international politics.
Certainly, Hitler used it. He used the term New Order.
So it's not New World Order, is it? It's New Order.
A New Order in Nazism. The year 1941 will be, said Adolf Hitler, I am convinced, the historical year of a great European New Order.
So that's a European New Order, not a new global New World Order.
Yes, I don't think he was quite thinking that the German Empire was going to take over the world.
He got the Japanese and the Americans and the Russians to deal with, hadn't he?
And then we move forward to 1990, where Mikhail Gorbachev, and I think really it's Hitler's use of the expression New Order, which has caused quite a lot of people to back away from using the term. Anyway, Mikhail Gorbachev in 1990, in a speech, talked of pluralism, tolerance and cooperation for a new type of progress throughout the world to become a reality. Everyone must change. Tolerance is the alpha and omega of a new world order. And also, 1990, A. Ralph Epperson wrote a book, The New World Order, presenting a Masonic New World Order conspiracy theory. In also around about the same time, this is in 1990, George Bush Sr. and the Gulf War. In September the 11th, funnily enough, 1990, George Bush Sr. Gave a speech, and he also talked about a new world order then, and we've got a recording of that, so let's have a listen to that now.
We have before us the opportunity to forge for ourselves and for future generations a new world order, a world where the rule of law, not the law of the jungle, governs the conduct of nations. When we are successful, and we will be, we have a real chance at this new world order, an order in which a credible United Nations can use its peacekeeping role to fulfill the promise and vision of the UN's founders.
So he's seeing a sort of vision, the UN vision for the future, Martin. But George Bush is quite a controversial figure, George Bush Sr., isn't he?
Well, yes. I mean, he was involved in the Iran-Contra affair, which involved bringing massive amounts of cocaine into the United States of America in order to fund an illegal terrorist war in Nicaragua that killed 30,000 civilians. Yes, he is a bit of a controversial figure.
In 1994, Henry Kissinger used the term, the New World Order cannot happen without US participation, as we are the most significant single component. Yes, there will be a New World Order, and it will force the United States to change its perceptions. What do you think he means by that?
I think what they all mean is the new world order is what people want it to mean. It's either aspirational, we want a new world order of motherhood and apple pie and good things that we all agree with, rule of law, etc., or it's used in a negative sense as new world order is a conspiracy by the Illuminati, the bankers, the people behind the scenes to create a one world government. That's the main dialogue in the United States is about that.
Well, a lot of these senior politicians in the United States,
many people on the right see the United Nations as a threat to American hegemony. So the idea of a rules-based system seems to be threatening because the American right-wing don't want any rules. They're happy with no rules as they stand.
Well, Gordon Brown and Tony Blair both used the term between 2000 and 2009. Blair saying, there is a new world order, like it or not. And also, more recently, President Ahmadinejad, the Iranian president, in an interview with Iranian radio, said, it is time to propose a new ideology for running the world. Well, that wasn't actually using the expression, and maybe he was deliberately avoiding it.
I think he possibly was, because the word New World Order has got associated with some rather extreme conspiracist views in the United States. But everybody, of course, aspires to a better world as they see it, Ahmadinejad included. And presumably it would include, lots of things that he would approve of.
And Georgia, the president, Mikhail Saakashvili, used the term recently too. We are also fighting for world peace, and we are also fighting for a future world order, he said.
Yes, we're not a new world order, a future world order. I mean, basically, people get confused about the use of language. New world order in the strict conspiracy sense implies a one world government used by the United Nations through the United Nations to subordinate America to the United States to other people's wishes. That's the paranoia of the pros who use the term new world order. And of course, new world order is also paranoidly used on the left, because it's a new world order run from Washington with a single superpower, the United States, telling everybody else what to do. You could also use it in that way. But basically, we've just got to be useful about the way we use language. We've got to be precise, basically.
I think it's probably wise to avoid the term, the term New Order, which Hitler used. Anyway, that's all for this week. Coming up next, the Sky News at 7. Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour, Deputy Leader of the Conservative Group and Councillor for Henbury, Mark Weston, and to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Next week, Lib Dem MP for Bristol West, Stephen Williams.